From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. It is Friday. Thank goodness. It's been a long week. Anyway, it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Logan Finney with Idaho Public Television, and our very own Julie Licata with Boise State Public Radio News. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, Gemma.
So, Don, let's begin with zoning in the city of Boise. Who knew that it would get so much attention? But there are folks on both sides of this issue. It's very heated. So first, can you update us on why the city decided to start looking at possibly changing our zoning codes? And then, as I said, people are on both sides of this issue, and this is heating up. So where are we with all of this?
Yeah, actually, the heat is probably dissipated this morning. Let's start by talking about what zoning is, because I think that is easy to get lost. It's the rules and regulations that dictate what can be built on properties. And so those decisions that are made at a political level tell you if you can build a 10-story building, build a 1-story building, whether you have to have parking for 0 cars or 50 cars. It can even tell you how sustainable the building must be, what it looks like, and all sorts of things. In the early 2000s, or the early 2010s, I should say, the city adopted what it calls Blueprint Boise, and it's the comprehensive plan for the city, and it's the big picture idea of what Boise should look like. But the rules that actually underpin that vision were written in the late 1960s. And while they've been updated and incrementally changed over the years, they've been in conflict. So what's in the comprehensive plan and what's in the zoning code haven't aligned. And the city believes that in recent years, we've started to see some problems with that, primarily because people who are trying to do projects, develop things, are coming in and saying, hey, we want to do this thing, but we're going to need an exemption for height. We're going to need an exemption for how far it can be away from buildings. We're going to need an exemption for how many parking spaces it needs, and on and on. And that, the city says, is an indication that the code needs to be updated to match what's actually in that big blue sky, blue big picture plan. Mm. And so in 2019, under former Mayor Dave Beter, they started a process to do this. And they actually said they were going to start earlier. The Blueprint Boise was adopted in 2011, and for 8 years, the city just didn't do anything. And in 2019, they said, you know what, maybe we should get at this because it's causing problems. And they did. And so over the next nearly 5 years, the city engaged in a process that involved an outside consultants, involved city staff, involved more than two dozen meetings of a team of citizens to plan, and then a fairly lengthy public process. And they came up with this document, and I have it on my desk here. And as you know, Gemma, I like a sound effect once in a while. That's the 600 pages hitting my desk. It is massive. And earlier this spring, I spent about a week and a half. I stepped out of most of my daily duties, and I read the code and did research and talked to people and tried to get our arms around it. And one of the things that came up repeatedly during the hearings at the city council this week to make a decision on this was there's really no one headline to this code. And in fact, the story that we wrote on this is almost 4,000 words long. And that was us trying to distill the plan. Mm. But what they hope it will do is increase the ease of building housing units in the city. They hope that it will make transit more possible, that it'll make it easier for you to walk from your home to a neighborhood shop or to buy groceries or get an ice cream. They hope that it will help boost the city's sustainability goals to make the city more sustainable as our climate continues to warm and change. And so whenever you're going to do something that's 600 pages, it's going to bring a lot of emotion. And throughout this week, Margaret Carmel or I sat in on every minute of the testimony, of which there was 3 nights of, and then a 4th night of deliberation and discussion. And I was struck at a couple of things. One, the testimony in favor of the code was about 2-1, and that's an imperfect measure. And what the real sentiment is will be seen, I think, at the ballot box this fall. But a lot of people came forward with concern over what this was going to do to the character of their neighborhoods, what it was going to mean for their themselves and their children. And they often came with very specific things that they said, this doesn't do, this should be changed. And last night during the hearing on this, Council President Holly Woodings made a motion to approve the new zoning code. It was adopted unanimously by all six council members. But when she did that, she made a list of 20 changes that they want to see to the code. And these are big things. They're small things. And having listened to almost all the testimony, what I was struck by was that the council listened to some of that feedback and tried to make changes. In the noon edition of Idaho Matters, you played a soundbite from council member Jimmy Halliburton just in the news break before. And one of the things he said is we can't let perfect be the enemy of doing something. And what I think is important for people to think about is doing nothing is a choice. And for years, the city didn't do anything. They left the zoning code alone, and that was a choice. And in that time, since 2011, when this is adopted, we've seen home prices more than double. We've seen rent prices nearly triple. We've seen a lot of people move here. We've seen people having trouble finding a place to live. And in all economic statuses, this is not something that is unique. We saw people of all different socioeconomic classes up there testifying that they were having trouble finding housing. And so the city has decided to do something. Now we're going to see what that looks like. And this is a story that has really only begun because the code will go into effect in December. They have said that they will, the council in December of 2024, so a year after it's adopted, will review and make changes. That council is likely to be quite a bit different. We'll have different council members. You could have a new mayor, depending on what happens at the ballot box this year. And so they'll make decisions about what to change. But we're not going to know the form of this for a very long time. This development, while it seems like it's happening fast in our city, it really takes a long time for significant changes to happen.
Mm-hmm. So I know, Don, that I think Margaret wrote an article this morning that was published in regards to this. And I know you said, okay, so they talked about these 20 changes. Mm-hmm. Was there any of them that stuck out to you that, you know, you say that they listened to, you know, to folks. I mean, one that stuck out to me was daycares being allowed in any mixed use zone. And for people maybe who, you know, it's been a long time since you've had kids or maybe you don't have children, I think that's incredibly important that you're not putting these daycares in places where they are really difficult to get to because they impact, you know, people's livelihood. If you can't find good care for your children within, you know, basically any area of the city.
Yeah, and that was one of the changes that they picked up on, and that was driven by testimony. I was struck. There was one piece. There was just one person who testified about this, and they were they brought concern forth that when a developer platted their subdivision, proposed their subdivision in the early 2000s in Boise. They promised a trail and it's 2023, 20 plus years later, and the trail hasn't been built. And the reason for that is because the development's not done. It's being built in phases as demand comes along. And so the houses are still being constructed and they don't have to do it until the development's done. And the council picked up on that and went, oh, that doesn't work. And so they put a requirement in the code that after it's adopted, that those types of amenities must be done within a year of the first occupancy permits for the development, which means that this one person from one neighborhood association took the time out of their day to show up at City Hall and say, hey, here's an issue. And they fixed it. And so, you know, while it won't actually help that neighborhood because they're grandfathered in under the old code, in the future, if a developer says we're going to build a trail, they're going to have to build the dang trail instead of waiting a generation or two to do it. And I think it's easy to get caught in the like 20 changes they made last night, right? Because mm-hmm. it's a thing where we have a recency bias and people are looking at that. But if you go to our homepage and you look at the story that Margaret wrote, you can read that. But linked within it is a story we did in March that was a deep dive into the actual code. And you can read what's actually in it, and you can digest and understand what's to come. And the way we framed Margaret's story last night is it's the future of Boise, and it really is. It's the way the city's going to look, the way it's going to mm-hmm. operate, the way our buildings are going to look and feel, the way our neighborhoods are going to be. And it's going to be something that people who live here will see and feel for a long time.
Yeah. So folks, I mean, definitely go to boisedev.com if you want to do a deeper dive into this.
It's really hard to sum this up on the radio.
It is, but I think you did a great job, Don. You really did.
Thanks.
But there's so much to get to. So definitely go to boisedev.com. Rachel, I want to bring you into the conversation because some news coming out of the Nampa School District. This is in regards to possibly banning teachers and staff from discussing gender identity and expression. Can you talk to us more about this?
Yes. So the school, Nampa School Board is actually, you know, they've had a couple readings or at least one reading of this policy. And on Monday, actually, they are going to be having another reading. And then my understanding is it will possibly go to a vote. And basically, what it looks like is, I don't know, I imagine all the reporters on this show and maybe some listeners remember when there was kind of that uproar in Nampa over this psychology class that mm-hmm. had a test question, and one of the test questions asked, you know, how many genders there were, and the answer was I think the answer was you know, any amount or an unknown amount right now. And people got really upset, you know, saying that there are only two genders, and, you know, that kind of spurred a lot of discussion in school board meetings. So since then, and also since the Idaho legislature, you know, basically kind of made these types of policies okay, the Nampa School Board is proposing a policy that basically prohibits teachers, students, staff from discussing gender identity, gender expression, things like that. Basically, it sounds like a teacher is not required by policy to follow a student's preferred pronoun, use a student's preferred pronoun, things like that. And, you know, for my story, I talked to the ACLU of Idaho, and it just kind of, you know, we've seen these types of policies, you know, they've been called, you know, don't say gay policies. And, mm-hmm. You know, the ACLU sued, I believe, a school district in Indiana, I think, over a policy like this, you know, because their position is basically, you know, this takes away freedom of speech from teachers, students. It, you know, kind of also just socially sends a message to kids who are LGBTQ+, and, you know, just kind of sends a message that they're not part of, you know, the history or the community. And, you know, that is something they have a problem with. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't hear the end of this on Monday.
So that's when they will take that vote, is Monday?
Yes.
Okay. So Logan, tell us about a Meridian man getting arrested because he is allegedly fired shots in the Hell's Canyon Dam. First off, this didn't seem to get a lot of attention. But secondly, Idaho Public Television, you guys delved into this more because you looked into our state's energy grid, right? And how this could be impacted. So talk to us about this.
Yeah, this is kind of a, well, in my opinion, kind of a wild story that broke this weekend there's a Meridian resident who early Friday morning, there were reports filed with the Adams or Washington County Sheriff's Office of gunshots out by the Hell's Canyon and Brownlee Dams, which are part of the Hell's Canyon Dam complex operated by Idaho Power. And that supplies approximately 70% of the state's energy supply. So the sheriff's deputies went out to investigate, and this is largely based on reporting by KTVB and by Nicole Blanchard at the Idaho Statesman. So definitely a shout out to those reporters for their work. Law enforcement found a man on a motorcycle who matched the description, and he took off down the highway. The arrest affidavit included details like he sped through a 25 mile per hour zone in the town of Cambridge, going about 80 miles per hour. Wow. Eventually stopped on the highway and deputies arrested him. They found a gun case with two rifles, as well as two tire repair cans, is how they were described. So like a fix-a-flat type of thing. But according to officers, those smelled of gasoline. And so the man is being held in Washington County, and the Adams County Sheriff's Office also noted that they worked with the FBI to execute a search warrant at his home in Meridian. And he is being charged with with malicious injury to property for the damage to the power substations, attempting to flee from law enforcement going through Cambridge, as well as possession of destructive devices, which I believe applies to the tire repair cans, and that kind of points toward law enforcement thinking these were kind of homemade explosives potentially.
Wow. Okay. So then you dug into if something like this were to happen, I mean, this could potentially shut down our energy grid in the state. I mean, if more damage had been done, potentially.
Possibly, yeah. We reached out to Idaho Power, and they gave us a statement that no one was injured and the damaged equipment was repaired quickly and no customers experienced any outages. Your listeners may remember back earlier in the year, in January, there were reports of things like this, of people shooting at power substations in Washington State and over on the East Coast. So at that time, I spoke with Will Hart, who is the executive director of the Consumer-Owned Utilities Association here. So that is your small rural co-ops or a small municipal power company that's operated by a city in the service areas where somewhere like an Avista or an Idaho Power don't reach. And because of the interconnected nature of the grid, all of these utility providers work together to help ensure that the grid stays on. And they've done some work, especially looking at cybersecurity and, kind of the work that Idaho National Lab is involved with that they can't share a lot of details about, because if you told everyone your security plans, they're not that secure anymore.
Exactly,
With the attention on these type of attacks happening in other parts of the state, Idaho, and specifically the Office of Energy and Mineral Resources, which is a body in the governor's office, they have some funding from the bipartisan infrastructure bill. The state of Idaho is getting $25 million over the next 5 years from the Infrastructure and Jobs Act for grant programs that the state government is able to give to these power companies to help ensure resilience and ensure that the grid stays on.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that update. Dawn, you mentioned this briefly when in our last segment talking about zoning codes, but this is the price of housing and how it has gone up so much over the last few years. For a little while, the last couple of months, we've seen a dip, but latest numbers have come out and Ada County's numbers are back on the rise.
Yeah, we've seen several months in a row of rising prices in Ada County, and then we've started to see an uptick in Canyon County as well. Mm-hmm. For Ada County, the price, the median price of a home sold in May was $535,000, which is up about 30% from April.
Wow.
Important to note, that's down by 11% from May of 2022. So the year before, you can start to see that thing trending back up. May of 2022 was actually the all-time high median price in Ada County, just over $600,000. Prices in Canyon County also on the rise, just ticking up over $400,000. But what's kind of interesting here is a couple of things. One, as people know, mortgage rates are high and have been elevated now for more than a year, which has changed the market quite a bit. And Realtor.com did a national survey that said that 82% of people polled said they felt locked into their current home by a mortgage rate. And so what that means is people are maybe a little reluctant to sell. And we're seeing that in the data here, where there were fewer homes for sale than a year ago, and fewer homes sold than a year ago. So we've got this kind of funny little dynamic where you're seeing a little bit of a slowdown in the market, but the prices are going back up, partly because we're still out of balance on demand. Some of this might be seasonal, and if you look at more traditional seasonal trends, and honestly, to do that, you've got to go back like 6 or 7 years, but you often see a bit of an increase coming into the spring, levels off towards the hot part of the year, then decreases in the fall. So that might be what's at play here. As I've said on the show a number of times, predicting the real estate market is a fool's errand, so we won't do that. But prices are getting a little more expensive, and those interest rates are certainly a factor. And what happens nationally with the Fed impacts what happens here in Boise and the Treasure Valley at large.
Right. Yeah. So, Julie, I know you've been doing a lot of research and reporting lately on health disparities facing Idaho's Hispanic community. What have you found out?
Well, it's been an interesting couple of weeks. Mostly, this is not breaking news. These are numbers that have been released recently through a study by the University of Idaho in conjunction with the Idaho Commission on Hispanic Affairs have released this report, which coincided with also Idaho's first Hispanic and American Indian Health Conference. So we received a lot of numbers, and I think some of them, the starkest ones, are ones related to poverty and access to medical care. And in Idaho, which is not unique to the state, Hispanics experience poverty at twice the rate of non-Hispanics, which leads to other poorer health outcomes, including the fact that Hispanics are 3 times as likely to not have health insurance as non-Hispanics.
So with this information that's been released, Julie, and they've, you know, this conference has been held for the first time. Mm-hmm. Are there, plans of action, or is it more like, let's get this information out to the broader community, so those of us who are not within that Hispanic community can understand more and maybe do something to make this disparity less?
Well, I think the goal of this report was mostly to capture measurements of health behavior in the state. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of interpretation. I think we can understand that obviously folks who experience poverty are less likely to have good health outcomes. I think that's fairly intuitive. One of the panels that I attended at this conference in Twin Falls last week, folks who were working on food insecurities said things that I thought were pretty poignant, including rent eats first, which means that obviously folks who are on a budget and who are in an increasingly tighter budget will make sacrifices, not necessarily on their bills. They're going to try to keep a roof over their heads. And they're going to sacrifice on food. And the second thing that they will sacrifice on is medical expenses, especially medical insurance, which is a more nebulous thing. It's easier to say, oh, well, this month, maybe I'm not going to pay my premium and I'm going to hope not to have an emergency. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of local organizations are trying to address. I mean, this is a systemic kind of a broad problem. And I think they are, you know, local organizations are trying to address things at the community level by, you know, providing services. So there's the food bank, there's the Hunger Coalition in Blaine County. And so there's attempts at reaching out to the community, and some of the barriers to access to food and to local services and to medical care within the Hispanic community is language barriers. So there's, I think, efforts across the board to have volunteers, service providers who are bilingual, who are able to understand cultural sensitivity and to reach out to folks directly. Some other numbers that came out of this report is that the Hispanic community is grossly underrepresented in the medical field. Mm-hmm. So, for example, this is just one example, but in Idaho, about 13% of the community is Hispanic, but only 5% of nurses are Hispanic in Idaho. So there's less likely to have a cultural understanding. There's more mistrust. Obviously, representation matters. So if you don't see folks who look like you, who may understand your cultural background, you're less likely. And also just in general, like nobody likes to go to the doctor. Nobody likes to go to the dentist. And if you feel like you're in a foreign place because your providers don't understand you, you're less likely to engage with them.
Yeah, makes sense. So, Logan, there is a proposed voter initiative that would change how Idaho conducts elections. We've spoken about it on our program before, but the Attorney General's office has come out, and they are now saying that this violates not just the state constitution, but the federal constitution. Can you explain this for us?
Yes. And actually, Gemma, I want to take a quick second before we move on. I may have misspoken in the last segment, so I wanted to say the Hell's Canyon complex, that accounts for 70% of Idaho Power's hydro generation, not of power for the whole state. Just want to make sure I wasn't misrepresenting that.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. Appreciate that.
As far as this ballot initiative goes, folks are probably familiar with Reclaim Idaho. They are the group that spearheaded the Medicaid expansion campaign, as well as the Quality Education Act campaign, which they ultimately pulled from the ballot for political reasons. They have, along with members of their coalition, put together a new ballot initiative that would change the way that primary elections and general elections are done here. As part of the ballot initiative process, all of the ballot initiatives that are submitted undergo a review by the Attorney General's office. Just to check to make sure there's nothing majorly wrong with them. It doesn't have internal conflicts, things like that. And so this is the first one that has come out under the new Attorney General administration under Attorney General Raul Labrador. And yes, they identified a whole slew of what they saw as issues with the initiative. for example, the state constitution says that executive branch officers, if you get the most amount of votes, then you win the election and you win your seat. And so the Attorney General says that if we were to implement a ballot measure where there was a ranked choice voting scheme in the general, he argues that it would be unconstitutional to do additional rounds of tabulation if someone had already gotten the most number of votes. And you also referenced, the review references the federal constitution. So the U.S. Constitution specifically has a section that says the rules of the elections shall be up to the state legislatures of each state. And that's a provision that essentially means it's the states that run their elections, not the federal government. There's a school of thought that's become popular in recent years with the increased intention on elections that really hones in on that word legislature in the Constitution and interprets that to mean that state legislatures are the final authority when it comes to how states do their elections, and that even courts and governors and secretaries of state can't overrule them. Of course, that theory of constitutional law has not been super popular in the courts, but it is definitely a theory that is thrown out there. And so as part of this review from Labrador's office, they say the U.S. Constitution says state legislatures decide the election rules, so the citizens couldn't change them themselves with a ballot initiative. Of course, this would have to go to a court eventually to get a final say on the matter. This review that's done by the Attorney General Office is purely advisory, and the initiative organizers have about another week to make any final changes to their draft before they submit it and can start actually collecting signatures.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the update on that. Don, Sun Valley is about to turn up even more exclusive than it is sometimes. And this is because the annual Allen & Company conference is about to get underway. So folks who may not be familiar with this, Don, can you tell everyone what it is? But I mean, then you've got, I think it's fair to say, moguls, whether they're media moguls or, I mean, just, you know, it runs the gamut. But man, the amount of people with tremendous wealth that go to Sun Valley every July is something.
Yeah, the annual conference for the 1% descends on the Sun Valley Resort right after the 4th of July. Literally, the fireworks end and the famous people and the jets roll in.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
This is a big boost to the Wood River Valley economy every year. Not only does the resort essentially close and turn into a private country club, which helps certainly the holding family that owns the Sun Valley Resort, but it spills over to the greater community as well. A lot of people are brought into service to babysit and guide rafts and serve meals at Michelle's Christiana and all sorts of things up there. Each year, the company that puts this on, it's an investment firm called Allen & Co., which has done this since the 1980s. Somehow, magically, the guest list makes its way into the hands of Daily Variety, which is a Hollywood trade publication.
Right.
Like clockwork, every year Variety gets this. And so we usually do a story because it's interesting to yeah. see. And, you know, lots of big names. And we're not talking like, oh, you know, somebody you maybe saw on CNN once, but Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway, Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, Mark Zuckerberg, who I think owns a couple of social media platforms, Oprah Winfrey, and on it goes. Prime ministers, Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, and on and on. And so this conference is fairly secretive. I've traveled up there 3 or 4 times over my news career to cover it. And by covering it, I mean I basically sit in the conditori and watch for people to come by. There's really not much for reporters to see.
I've personally seen
Mark Zuckerberg stroll by a few years ago. This year, you're going to have the commissioners of the NBA, NFL, Major
right.
League Baseball, the PGA, which is very timely right now. Peter Thiel, a large conservative donor and the founder of PayPal, will be there. And they, from reports that we've seen in the past, they talk about geopolitical issues. There's been a number of fairly significant mergers, particularly in the media sector, that are hatched here. Because a couple of executives go off and maybe have lunch or play a round of golf and talk about the ways their companies could be better together. And so this is a pretty big deal up there. And the culture of Sun Valley, for anybody who's been in the Sun Valley Ketchum area, is pretty interesting. It has kind of a small town, kind of an Idaho feel. But also sort of feels like a little bit of a different place. And the people who live there often don't really pay a lot of mind to the celebrities. Arnold Schwarzenegger is known to get breakfast at the Needery often and just sits there like anybody else, former action star and governor of California, and doesn't really faze people. And so it's always been kind of a fascination for me just to see this. People don't always love it because it is very much an establishment crowd and people, as our society has changed and wealth inequity has increased, have some issues with that. But definitely something interesting that happens right here in our backyard each summer.
Well, and Don, I would say this very quickly, and I do need to wrap here in a second, is I do think you make a good point, though, about the disparity and the inequity,
yeah.
because all you have to do is drive by the airport during this conference.
Yes.
I mean, just the private jets alone, I mean, the disparity is almost laughable. And I don't say that to be funny, but I mean, it's really stark and striking.
It is, especially as the Wood River Valley community, like many communities in our state, are suffering from significant housing challenges, and finding people to work in these businesses. The Sun Valley Resort benefits because they have an international visa program, but a lot of the businesses struggle up there just to find workers because those workers can't find places to live, and then you have the richest of the rich roll in each July to enjoy the scenery. So it's a complicated thing, I think, and has become more complicated in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the same time, it's super fascinating, I think, you know, and your curiosity is piqued when you see the list of people who come to, you know, Idaho, right? I mean, it's Sun Valley, but it's Idaho. They come to Idaho every summer for this conference. And so that's a bit mind-boggling. But it is, I think it's important for people to just recognize too. I mean, you're right, that disparity where when you have workers that have to be bused in from like Twin Falls and things like that because they can't afford to live there, that is something that we need to be talking about. But at the same time, always fascinating to talk about this. Yeah. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming in today and spending your lunch hour with us to talk about what has been going on here in our state this week. So a big thank you to Rachel Spotcheck with the Idaho Statesman, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Logan Finney with Idaho Public Television, and our very own Julie Laqueta with Boise State Public Radio News. Please go to all of their websites and their television stations and read and listen and watch their reporting. We've got great journalists in our state. Thank you, everybody. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.